Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how spice beats chemotherapy and radiation and surgery for brain cancer, a new study you haven't heard about. And also, why do people sacrifice short-term happiness for long-term welfare? The Imperial College London has something to say on that. And eating more fruits and vegetables can substantially increase happiness levels. That's from University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. Also, the latest study confirms that a particular nutrient that we don't get much of is called berberine, can halt breast cancer. I'll share that with you as well. And melatonin is superior to toxic drugs in migraine prevention study. And more on health and healing. Then recently, I filmed Dr. Colin Campbell in Ithaca at Cornell. Very provocative interview. And he just published an article from the Center for Nutrition Studies at Cornell called Animal Protein Linked to Death. I thought you'd find this interesting, so I'll share that with you. Also, today, some commentaries. We're going to have a commentary on nutrition politics and the destruction of scientific integrity. We're also going to look at, from Michael Payne from Nation of Change, the U.S. government is hooked on obsession with perpetual war. And also from Robert Perry, Common Dreams, the dumbed-down New York Times. Also today from the American Herald Tribune, Vanessa Bealey, the bloody legacy of American exceptionalism. And also, I'm going to have this fellow on in the near future, as soon as I return to New York. He has written a very important report. His name is Bradley Birkenfeld. You probably have never heard of him, but he's the one who exposed the biggest financial corruption scandal in history, UBS, the Swiss banking giant. In fact, it's the world's largest wealth manager, and they paid a fine of $780 million. Why didn't they go to trial? Well, he did, and he went to jail for 31 months for exposing this. So how does a person that exposes the crime, a whistleblower, get 31 months in prison on one count of conspiracy to abet tax evasion by one of his clients, and yet UBS got away with one day's worth of income? I'll deal with that, and you'll hear more on that in an upcoming program. Also today, the best way to address the individuals who strongly support Hillary Clinton and the neocons she surrounds over at NBC, MSNBC, CNN, and other networks is maybe not hear from an expert, not a politician, not one of the best and brightest out of Harvard. Why don't we listen to an 11-year-old Iraqi boy has one of the most crucial questions for all Americans. Also today, I was invited by a group of Haitian activists to a demonstration in front of Clinton's office. I showed up. I was there the whole time. I gave a speech because a lot of people in this audience are from Haiti and they know my long-term commitment to seeking justice for Haitians and exposing, I go clear back to exposing Papa Doc Duvalier and his dreaded Tonton Matoons and his death squads. You're going to hear something today you've not heard. So as you see, we have an audience that's worldwide. We have an awful lot of people listening and going to the website every day to see the latest articles that are posted. We try to post between 1 to 200 articles a day on progressive themes. And we thank you for doing that. We just got an award on Friday. I was out of town. And that we are number one radio show in the world as far as listening live over the internet. Now we're number one listening to the archives. So a lot of people are listening out there. So we thank you. I'm sorry I did not have a chance to announce that I was going to be doing not one, not two, but three back-to-back-to-back specials, 6 hours, on PBS Denver on Saturday evening. But I'm in the midst of a major filming and travel schedule to complete another documentary in the next 2 weeks. So I'll let you know when the programs are airing, or you can just check with Channel 12 Denver and you can see for yourself. Let's begin. Melatonin is superior to toxic drugs for migraine. Now, according to Sayer G. over at GreenMedInfo, which, by the way, is one of the best information sources in America, melatonin, as we know, is a substance that's secreted from your brain. And when you get a good night's sleep, you secrete more melatonin. If you awaken during the night, that stops the production of melatonin. And your brain is a far superior source of melatonin than taking a toxic pharmaceutical to, let's say, help reduce migraine headache frequency. There is a research section entitled Superiority of Natural Substances Versus Drugs, which catalogs research from the National Library of Medicine. Now, that's the official source of medical science for the government. So let's say you want to testify before Congress, or you're a congressman or woman, and you want to see whether or not the information you're being given is objective or accurate, you go to the Library of Medicine, where supposedly only the best science is. Here's the irony. If you go to the government's own website and you Google medical marijuana, you'll come up with over 15,000 references. Thousands of completely legitimate peer-reviewed studies showing what marijuana extracts do, the cannabinoids, for brain cancer, lung cancer, immune system, and all these other conditions. And yet, the DEA said that they couldn't find a single study supporting the medical validation of marijuana, so they're keeping it a Class 1 drug. I'm writing an article on this because it has nothing in the world to do with science. The science is overwhelming of how important it is. It's all the politics and, by the way, the alcohol industry that's giving money to the legislators who then put pressure on the DEA. In any case, they have all this science there showing what different types of therapies do. And the newest addition to this special category of studies includes 7,600 topics, which you can peruse whenever you want. Just go to the research dashboard and you'll find it. And there we have the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery and Psychiatry, which compared melatonin, that's the hormone your brain secretes from your pineal gland, and then it compares it to the most commonly prescribed drugs for the prevention of migraine headaches. The drug title is, the drug article is called Randomized Clinical Trial Comparing Melatonin 3 Milligrams with the amitriptyline 25 milligrams and a placebo for migraine prevention. And they simply want to see which is better. Well, the study pointed out that migraine disorder is a debilitating and chronic neurological condition. It affects upwards of 20% of the entire world's population. And almost all the people who have these migraines seek the orthodox treatment and get the drugs. And when you have migraines, you can end up with unusual thoughts and behavior, lightheadedness, sometimes you pass out, chest pain, pain spreading to your jaw and shoulders, nausea, pounding heartbeat, a fluttering in your chest, confusion, seizures, convulsions, a painful urination, easy bruising, sudden weakness or feeling ill and fevers, a nausea, mouth pain. So it's not a little matter. Well, here's what's important. The new study was conducted using a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled protocol. And the results, quote, mean headache frequency reduced was 2.7 migraine per headache days in the melatonin group and that was more than the placebo group for the drug group. Quote, author's conclusion, melatonin 3 milligrams is better than placebo for migraine prevention, more tolerable than the orthodox drug, and as effective as the orthodox drug at 25 milligrams. So there you have good science, double-blind, placebo-controlled in the government's own database. And yet what do one bet that 99.99% of all doctors, A, haven't read the study, but will immediately tell you it doesn't exist or that there's no benefit to it. So you know the truth now. University of Warwick, article published in the American Journal of Public Health, shows that, quote, eating more fruits and vegetables can substantially increase people's later happiness level. This is the first major scientific attempt to explore psychological well-being beyond the traditional finding that fruit and vegetables can reduce cancer and heart disease. Now, this is rather unusual because happiness benefits were detected for each extra daily portion of fruit and vegetables up to 8 portions per day. I believe you should have 12 to 13. The researchers conclude that people who changed from almost no fruit and vegetables to 8 portions of fruit and vegetable a day would experience an increase in life satisfaction equivalent to moving from unemployment to employment. And the well-being improvements occurred within 24 months. And so why? What is behind this? Well, let me give you an example. Recently, I took a week to help a group of people from our sister station, WBAI. The goal was to help them with lifestyle and behavior modification, but it also helped. We managed to send out, pick, pack, and ship, pay for over 800 premiums. So there are no outstanding premiums that I have from previous fund drives. I'm not talking about the current one, which hopefully they'll be getting the books in and shipping them right out. In any case, I notice this all the time, and that is when people go to a retreat, almost the first day they're coming off caffeine and sugar and the usual large volume of food that they're used to eating at a given meal, eating in between meals when they're not hungry and they still have food in their stomach, nervous habits, finding it difficult just to rest and relax or meditate because they're normally at that point finding something to distract them, like going on social websites or phone calls. But by the third day, when their body begins to rebalance, all because of healthy choices, waking up and having some lemon, organic lemon water, and then after you'd go for a power walk, having some watermelon and fruits, then having a protein shake after you do your yoga, then having a gourmet vegan meal, the body begins to rebalance itself, the good bacteria begin to multiply, the sense of satiety you can feel full with by eating less, you're actually putting everything into your body and mind that encourages good, healthy being, a state of being, a mindset. You begin to look forward to the day. You begin to be happy about the choices you made because you actually see it. Someone will say, gee, my face was broken out. Now it's clearing up. I used to be, unable to sleep. Now I'm sleeping through a night. I had these headaches and pains. They're gone. So all these things begin to occur about 3 to 4 days. And by the sixth day, you really see it. Now, this study is saying that it could take several months of making positive choices with fruits and vegetables, and then you're just happier. Well, of course you're happier when you don't have constipation. Of course you're going to be happier when you're not bloated and gaseous. Of course you're going to be happier when you have energy waking up in the morning and you don't have the swelling in your joints. And you're going to be happier when you know that you've made positive choices, and it only motivates you to take more positive choices. So someone begins to make minor change to the diet, within a month, maybe making 2 or 3 juices a day, or maybe going out to do more exercise, or might entertain yoga or meditation. So the happier you feel, the more you want to do, the happier you do feel, and it just keeps going up and up and up, and that's why. So it's all good. Now, there is an herb. It's called berberine, B-E-R-B-E-R-I-N-E. And according to the latest study, is very good for you. Now, we know, for example, that every living thing converts food into energy, and that is called metabolism. Cancer tumors are no exception, although cancer cells tend to get their energy in a way that is the exact opposite of healthy cells. Instead of utilizing the full process of aerobic cell respiration, tumor cells get their fuel through just what is called glycolysis alone, the process of converting glucose to ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate, through anaerobic means. So if you want cancer tumors to grow, deprive them of oxygen, stick them in a high acidic environment, meat, coffee, sugar, fried foods, and they're going to grow. On the other hand, if you want to halt the spread of tumors, then change the way they metabolize fuel. That's exactly how berberine is so effective in stopping cancer. Berberine changes cancer tumor cells on the metabolic level. It's one of the few compounds that is known to help activate the metabolic regulator AMPK, or adenosine monophosphate activated protein kinase. And resveratrol, by the way, is another. And when AMPK levels are adequate and protein is functioning properly, energy homeostasis can be achieved within the body, and glucose levels and lipid production stabilize, which is also one of the reasons where berberine is so effective for those with diabetes and metabolic syndrome as well. The loss of AMPK has been directly linked to cancer malignancy. So there's nothing in modern medicine that can help regulate AMPK for both cancer and other conditions. Berberine can. So just add that to one more way of using a non-toxic, healthy herb in the way that you control cancer. And finally, spice beats chemotherapy and radiation surgery for brain cancer. This is what this study shows. Now, according to the latest study, which was summarized by GreenMed Info, modern medicine or medical science is finally catching up to the wisdom of our ancestors. Spices, for instance, were once traded along ancient spice routes throughout Asia and Northeast Africa and Europe as highly precious commodities, and some of them were so prized for their life-saving properties, they were literally worth the same as gold. So there are a number of driving factors behind the increasing interest in natural substances as drug alternatives, as I just mentioned to you, with melatonin being one good example. And one of the reasons a lot of people are finally waking up and saying, wow, why do I want to use an over-the-counter and prescription drug, which is extremely dangerous and may not work as advertised, it may be ineffective and overpriced. In fact, some chemotherapy agents can cost 4,000 times more than gold by weight. And yet, there might be something natural. Well, turmeric is one of the most powerful healing spices known. And yet it is still modestly regulated to an FDA-approved food coloring agent instead of the safe, effective, affordable, and easily accessible remedy for the prevention and treatment of disease that it is. In total, there are at least 800 different conditions, with cancers, dozens of them, being the most thoroughly researched aspect of turmeric's properties. And recently, research has surfaced revealing it may help to combat one of the most lethal forms of cancer, glioblastomas. Now, for those of you who are not aware of it, a glio, G-L-I-O, blastoma, B-L-A-S-T-O-M-A, is a particularly fast-growing and deadly form of brain cancer, which, despite aggressive therapies, is associated with survival rates that rarely surpass 2 years. So given the poor prognosis and serious dangers linked to chemotherapy and surgery and radiation, natural solutions are what we should be paying attention to. Well, the first study published in the journal Medical Oncology, entitled Investigating the Therapeutic Role of Molecular Biology of Curcumin as a Treatment for Glioblastoma, looked at some animal and what is called in vitro, which means test tube, in vivo, V-I-V-O is animal studies, on turmeric extract curcumin and its ability to combat glioblastoma. And what they found was that it worked. It worked better than anything else they were trying. So add that to one of the things that can make an enormous difference for glioblastomas. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'll be back in the city in about 3 weeks after completing this latest documentary. My newest documentary, I just premiered one on PBS in Denver on Saturday night. In fact, two. Mark that, two new ones. But they also were playing Seeds of Death, and the program director said that it is the most watched and played documentary in the station's history. And she said it does very well late at night. How many times you played it? 2, 3, close to 60. That is a lot of times to play a documentary. So we thank them and the good people of Colorado for watching and better understanding the issues. How many times have you heard Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly, one of the neoconservatives, talk about American exceptionalism? And even the media has gone along with this. Now, we never talk about, in countries that we have invaded, what the people heading those countries that we, the United States, was trying covertly to get them out of power, to have regime change. We wanted to do this in Ukraine. We wanted to do it in Venezuela. Wanted to do it in Honduras. Did in Honduras. In Libya. And yet we never talk about, if you're to go in there, having no bias from the media, and just visit the country, not with any propagandists for the government, just the ability to walk around and talk with anyone in the city, in the suburbs, in the country, throughout the country, would your opinions match those of the demonized heads of state that we want to make sure that we all hated adequately enough so when they were sodomized and killed, we could laugh about it, as Hillary Clinton did, because it was her war. And the answer is, we never, as a part of our official policy, with the exceptions of a Chris Hedges or Robert Perry, Seymour Hersh, Paul Craig Roberts, we never go into these countries to look for the truth. Our truth comes from official media. And that official media is extraordinarily biased. Whether it's conservative or liberal media, it's biased. But what if you're just a person turning on the radio every day to hear Glenn Beck or Rachel Maddow? How would you know that they were biased? How would you know that what they were giving you were their personal points or what they had been given as talking points? You wouldn't. So let us begin by understanding that exceptionalism, the condition of being different from the norm, and also the theory expounding the exceptionalism, especially of a nation or a region, it's what we use in order to disempower people from being able to think. In effect, getting people into our control. And one of the ways you get people into your control is create fear. Fear at such a subconscious level that without even thinking, they will relinquish their power over reason to your power of reaction. Now, there are many theories surrounding the origins of American exceptionalism. We see it all the time, but according to Vanessa Bealey, the most popular in U.S. folklore being that it describes America's unique character of, quote, a free nation founded on democratic ideals and civil liberties. The Declaration of Independence from British colonial rule is the foundation of this theory, and it's preserved throughout the often violent history of the United States since its birth as a free nation. My point is that over time, exceptionalism has come to represent superiority in the minds and hearts of Americans. Belief in their economic superiority, their military superiority, their ideological supremacy is what has motivated successful U.S. governments to invest in shaping the world in their superior image with little or no regard for the destruction left in the wake of their exceptional hegemony. Now, in considering itself exceptional, the U.S. has extricated itself from any legal obligation to adhere to either international law or even the common moral laws that should govern humanity. The U.S. has become exceptionally lawless, authoritarian, particularly in its intolerant neo-colonialist foreign policy, and the colonized have become the colonists, concealing their brutal savagery behind a veneer of missionary zeal, that they are converting the world to their form of exceptionalist utopia. Such is the media and marketing apparatus that supports this superiority complex that the majority of U.S. Congress exists within its echo chamber and are willing victims of its indoctrination. The power of the propaganda vortex pulls them in and then radiates outwards, infecting all in its path. Self-extraction from this oligarchical perspective is perceived as a revolutionary act that challenges the core of U.S. security, so exceptionalism becomes the modus vivendi. Just as Israel considers itself the chosen people from a religious perspective, the U.S. considers itself the chosen nation to impose its version of democratic reform and capitalist hegemony the world over. One can now see why Israel and the United States make such symbolic bedfellows. Well, recently I had on this program Professor Paul Craig Roberts. In fact, he was on a week ago on the Progressive Commentary. It's worth listening to it. Very insightful man. He said, quote, "The fatal war for humanity is the war with Russia and China, towards which Washington is driving the U.S. and Washington's NATO and Asian puppet states. The bigotry of the U.S. power elite is rooted in its self-righteous doctrine that stipulates America as the indispensable country. So why do the American people accept U.S. criminal hegemony, domestic and foreign brutal tyranny, and neo-colonist bloodletting with scant protest? Why do the European vassal states not rise up against this authoritarian regime that flaunts international laws and drags its NATO, which I've said many times is a complete and totally corrupt criminal organization, down the path to complete lawlessness and diplomatic tyranny?" The psychological term, you may have heard of it, gaslighting, comes from the 1944 Hollywood classic movie called Gaslight. Gaslighting describes the abuse employed by a narcissist to instill in their victim's mind an extreme anxiety and confusion to the extent where they no longer have faith in their own powers of logic and reason and judgment. These gaslighting techniques were adopted by central intelligence agencies in the U.S. and Europe as part of their psychological warfare methods, used primarily during torture or interrogation. Gaslighting, as an abuser's modus operandi, involves specifically the withholding of factual information and its replacement with false or fictional information designed to confuse and disorient it. Now, this subtle and Machiavellian process eventually undermines the mental stability of its victims, reducing them to such a depth of insecurity and identity crisis they become entirely dependent upon their abuser for their sense of reality and even identity. Gaslighting involves a step-by-step psychological process that manipulates and destabilizes its victims. It is built over time and consists of repetitive information that feeds and enters the victim's subconscious over a period of time until it is fully registered on the subconscious hard disk and cannot be overridden by conscious thoughts. Put more simply, it's brainwashing. Overall, the main reason for gaslighting is to create a dynamic where the abuser has complete control over their victim so that they are so weak that they're very easily manipulated. The first stage depends upon trust in the integrity and impeachability or unimpeachability of intentions of the abuser, a state of reliance that has been engendered by the abuser's artful self-promotion and ingratiating propaganda. And once this trust is gained, the abuser will begin to subtly undermine it, creating situations and environments where the victim will begin to doubt their own judgment. Eventually, the victim will rely entirely upon the abuser to alleviate their uncertainty and to restore their sense of reality, which is in fact that of the abuser. The second stage is called defense. It's a process by which the abuser isolates the victim, not only from their own sense of identity, but from the validation of their peers. They are made to feel that their opinion is worthless, discredited, downright weird. In political circles, they would be labeled a conspiracy theorist, a dissident, a terror apologist, or a denialist, like a Holocaust denialist or an AIDS denialist. This is all pure propaganda. And as a consequence, the victim will withdraw from society and cease to express themselves for fear of ridicule and judgment or punishment. And this stage can also be compared to the Stockholm Syndrome, where a hostage or captive is reduced by psychological and mind games back to an infantile dependency upon their captor. And narcissistic abuse bonds the victim to the aggressor via trauma. And Stockholm Syndrome bonds the victim to the aggressor via regression to an infantile state where the abuser and aggressor becomes the parent who will rescue the victim from imminent annihilation. Both methods tap into the victim's survival mechanisms to gain and maintain control. And the final stage is depression. A life under the tyrannical rule of a narcissist drives the victim to a state of extreme confusion. They are stripped of identity, dignity, and self-reliance. They ultimately exist in an information vacuum, which is only filled by that which the abuser deems suitable or relevant. This can eventually invoke symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and flashbacks and constant apprehension, hypervigilance and mind paralysis and rage and even violence. The process is complete and the victim has been reduced to a willing accomplice in the abuser's creation of a very distorted reality. We're currently seeing the transformation of U.S. exceptionalism into an abusive narcissism. The gigantium apparatus of mind-bending and controlling is being put into hyperdrive by the ruling elite. We are inundated with propaganda that challenges our senses of reality, but only after being tenderized by the fear factor. Fear of terror, fear of war, fear of financial insecurity, fear of blacks, fear of migrants, fear of gun violence, fear of our own shadow. Once we subtly are quaking in our boots, in comes the rendition of reality that relieves our anxiety. If we challenge their version of events, we are labeled a conspiracy theorist, a threat to security. We are hounded, discredited, slandered, and ridiculed. We are isolated and threatened. Wars are started in the same way. Despite the hindsight that should enable us to see it coming, the process swings into motion with resounding success. The ubiquitous dictator, the oligarch, who threatens to destroy all that the U.S. and our allies represent, which of course is freedom, equality, and civil liberty, are wrapped up in the democracy's shining paper entitled with the exceptionalist ribbon. Next, the false flag to engender fear and terror and to foment sectarian strife. The support of legitimate, supposedly, indigenous revolutions, conveniently emerging in tandem with U.S. ambitions for imposing their model of governance upon a target nation. The arming of freedom fighters, the securing of mercenary additions to these manufactured proxy forces. All this is sold in the name of freedom and democracy to a public that is already in a state of anxiety and insecurity, lacking in judgment or insight into any other reality but that of their own abuser. Then, in addition, the humanitarians are deployed. Oh, did we forget them? We shouldn't. These are those little creeps who run the NGOs, the forces of our so-called good. You never hear about an NGO unless they're good. Well, I don't know any good NGOs. The vanguard of integrity and ethical intervention, they're the ones leading it. The power that offers all lost souls a stakeholding in the salvation of sovereign nations that have lost their way and need rescuing. The balm for a damaged soul to know they can leave their doubts and fears and in such trustworthy hands as Hillary Rodham Clinton or the people around her, Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch. They can assuage their deep sense of guilt at the suffering being endured by the people of far-flung nations because they can depend upon the NGOs to provide absolution with minimal effect on their part. They don't realize the NGOs are an integral part of their abuser's apparatus, operating on the leash of neo-colonialist financing and influence. Think of George Soros. He is the most maniacal on the planet. NGOs provide the optic through which the abuser will allow the victim to perceive their world, and once absorbed into this flawed prism, the victim's own cognitive dissonance will ensure they do not attempt a jailbreak. In this state of oppressed consciousness, the victim accepts what they are told. They accept the U.S. can sell cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia that obliterate human beings and lay waste to essential civilian infrastructure in Yemen. They accept that the U.S. financially, ideologically, and militarily supports the illegal state of Israel and provides the arsenal and experimental weapons that maim and mutilate children and civilians on a scale that is unimaginable. They accept that a crippling blockade of the already impoverished and starving nation of Yemen is necessary to resolve the issues of sectarian divisions that only exist in the minds of their congressional abusers. The majority of Americans accept mass murder under the pretext of the right to protect because their ability to form rational, reasoned opinions have been engineered out of them. This is now the definition of U.S. exceptionalism. This is Bill O'Reilly. This is Laura Ingraham. This is Megyn Kelly. This is Rachel Maddow. This is everyone on NBC, MSNBC. This is the entire media, including many on the left. In fact, the badness of this, it's especially the left where we've been sold out, and many popular radio shows. It is their ability to manipulate the world into accepting their lawlessness and global hegemony agenda. In seeking to impose its own image upon our world, the U.S. has drifted so far from its founding principles, one wonders how they will ever return. Do I believe they will? Not humanly possible. Only the most extreme naive would believe that we can reform or re-elect those to office in such a completely corrupt system. You've got to let it fail and start over. But this time, understand the importance of not allowing yourself to be propagandized. This is now the definition of U.S. exceptionalism in their ability to manipulate the world into accepting their lawlessness and their agenda. In seeking to impose our own image upon our world, and the U.S. has drifted so far from its founding principles, you ask, why? The U.S. has indeed achieved exceptionalism. The U.S. has become an exceptional global executioner and a prosecutor of humanity. Imperialism is a euphemism for the depths of abuse and depravity that the U.S. is inflicting upon all the people of the world. Our only hope is to break this cycle of abuse with empathy for the victims and with appreciation for the years of brainwashing that precedes their agonizing passive-aggressive apathy towards crimes being committed in their name. Now let's go to a clip, and let us not hear from the generals and NATO, the talking heads from the think tanks, both liberal and conservative, that all support the necessity to be in Iraq or other places. Let's hear from someone who lives there, an 11-year-old boy.
Hey, what's up? My name is Ali. I'm 11 years old. I'm from Baghdad, Iraq. I think most of you guys don't know Iraq or where it is on map. So I will tell you to ask your parents. If they are clever enough, they will tell you it was called Mesopotamia. In Mesopotamia, the land of history and civilization. American troops occupied Iraq in the year 2003, 2 years before my birth, telling Iraqi people they will free them from dictator. So they started the occupation, shocking and scaring everyone. They insulted all Iraqis. After 8 years, they left Iraq, leaving it like a ghost land. They left us without any safety, any smile, or any hope. Nothing left in my country, only people killing people because of the sectarian war. And ISIS occupies many cities in Iraq. So here I am, talking on behalf of millions of Iraqi children. They want to ask America one question. Are you satisfied with an end like this for your mission in Iraq? Leaving Iraqi people with fear, tears, pain, killing, blood, and destruction? I don't want to waste your time or mine. I'm not gonna tell you everything happening here in my country. I'm only gonna speak about Iraqi children. And I want you to hear me. You have to hear me. Because everything happening in my country happening because of you. So let me tell you something about Iraqi children. They are being killed because of ISIS, because of sectarian war. They are taken from their mothers to serve in ISIS camps. Can you believe that? In order to make them terrorists in future. So who refuses ISIS? Run away with his family, carrying what he can, walking for 500 miles through a road full of bombs and mines, tearing their little bodies apart. And if they survived and reached a safe place, they live in a tent. Imagine that. In this cold weather, you are living in a safe home, eating a hot, clean meal, covering your body with a warm clothes. But the poor children here live in a tent with a thin t-shirts on their bodies, eating anything they can find. So viva America! Is it cool now? Are you satisfied? Thanks, America. Thanks for everything. Thanks for lies. Thanks for leaving us with thieves, with terrorists, with ISIS. Thanks, America. Thanks again for making us see in blood more than anything in this life. At the end, I will say like you. Peace.
So, the next time those of you who are going to suck up to the Clintons, remember, everything that kid just said is because of Bush, Clintons, the liberal, and the conservative factions believing in the hegemony principle of new conservative principles, globalization. They've won. And we're not smart enough to see this? You don't have to worry about Trump. Trump doesn't need an opponent. He's got 15 different personalities fighting against each other each day. The serious ones are the ones you're not paying attention to what they're really about. This kid just called him out. I'm Gary Nall. Time for Talk Back. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. But for those of you in the New York Times and CNN who just can't get your head far enough up one of the Clintons' asses, why don't you pay attention? Go to Haiti. Go there and speak with the citizens. Ask Red Cross, you got $500 million. You were supposed to build tens of thousands of homes. I only found 6 homes in all of Haiti that wouldn't have cost you $100,000. What did you do with the other $599 million? Clintons, you raised $11 billion. Show me a penny of it that went for the average Haitian. I'll show you where the money went. Now you got something to think about.
The single largest relief project that the United States committed taxpayer dollars to, $124 million to be exact, was a project called Caracol, a textile factory that was built in the northern part of the country that was supposed to create some 60,000 jobs and was supposed to create tremendous economic growth.
There's a problem here already. You see, the earthquake affected the southern part of Haiti. The northern part of the country was entirely unaffected.
But who are the beneficiaries of this? Companies like Gap, Target, and Walmart, to name a few. The Caracol factory was built, but it didn't create 60,000 jobs. It created barely 5,000 jobs. But the major American companies who got textiles tariff-free, made at low wages, benefited enormously.
And the end effect on the Haitians was very, very minimal. If you look at some of the infrastructure projects that were undertaken, the Clintons had very grand plans to build large tracts of homes, and there were contractors that were selected for those projects. Sometimes the contractors had experience, sometimes they did not.
There's one company in Florida that spent $1 million getting equipment into Haiti. They had experience in disaster relief, but according to the owners of that company, they only made a small donation to the Clinton Foundation. And guess what? They didn't get any relief contracts. On the other hand, the contractors who did win the awards were given the opportunity to build homes, and in some instances were supposed to build tens of thousands of homes for Haitians. They ended up building a fraction of that. For instance, New Settlements Program was supposed to build 15,000 homes for $53 million. Instead, it built 2,600 homes, less than a quarter of the original estimate, for $90 million, or $47 million over budget.
And they got away with it.
So you had contracts going to these relief organizations that were also involved with the Clinton Global Initiative. And you had this one organization, Dahlberg, that was supposed to do an assessment for relocating people that suffered from the earthquake. They determined that people should be moved to a site that happened to be on a cliff that was highly unstable. USAID's Inspector General reviewed Dahlberg's recommendations and found them basically unusable. One member of the USAID shelter team was quoted by Rolling Stone magazine as saying that the recommendations were so bad, it looked like the team never even got out of their SUVs. Another person said that only one of the people that was sent to Haiti by Dahlberg actually spoke French.
Telecom mogul Dennis O'Brien is one of the world's richest people, and he's finding opportunities in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. The Irish billionaire is the largest private investor in Haiti through his company Digicel, and he's now leading the Clinton Global Initiative efforts down in Haiti.
Probably no one came out better in the Haitian reconstruction effort than an Irish billionaire named Dennis O'Brien. He is a Clinton Foundation donor, giving them between $5 and $10 million. He helped arrange speeches for Bill Clinton, too.
The interest of the Obama administration, particularly the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, you know, all the different things that have happened to help Haiti get up off the floor have been led by the U.S.
And he was the owner of something called Digicel, which is a cell phone company at the time of the earthquake. As part of that relief effort, the State Department run by Hillary Clinton wanted to fund a mobile money transfer service that would allow Haitian citizens to transfer and receive money on their phones. Well, Digicel applied to be the recipient of that grant money. 4 weeks after their application, Digicel actually sponsored a speech for Bill Clinton in Jamaica, and they paid him $225,000. And as it turns out, within 4 months of that speech, Digicel would receive the first installment of that grant money. The earthquake actually has been great for Digicel and Dennis O'Brien.
More than 4 years since a magnitude 7.0 earthquake devastated Haiti. And outrage there is growing over the largely failed reconstruction effort, despite the hundreds of millions of dollars in aid that has been collected and spent by the IHRC, the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission.
So whether you're talking about housing or cell phones, you see that the people that are closest to the Clintons have made out very well from the Haitian earthquake. The rest of the country, the ordinary people of Haiti, not so much.
Haitian activists stage a protest outside Hillary Clinton's Manhattan office. The demonstrators claim billions of dollars were stolen through the Haiti Reconstruction Commission headed by Bill Clinton. They also say Haiti was used as a cover for foreign governments to funnel kickbacks of possibly hundreds of millions of dollars through the Clinton Foundation. They say it was done in exchange for favors that Hillary was doing for them as Secretary of State.
The tragedy is we had an opportunity to rebuild in a way that would give the people of that country hope. Sadly, that opportunity was squandered, and what took place, rather than rebuilding Haiti, was the self-enrichment by friends of the Clintons. For all of Bill Clinton's talk about building Haiti back better, the fact remains that the most visible evidence of Clinton's role in the recovery isn't the improvement of daily life for everyday Haitians, but the construction of new luxury hotels just miles from the folks who have been living in tarps USAID handed out immediately after the earthquake.
We are telling the world of the crimes that Bill and Hillary Clinton are responsible for in Haiti.
But while the world eventually lost interest in Haiti's recovery, the influence and connections afforded to donors from the Clinton Foundation appear to have been lessons learned by others. So how much do connections to the Clintons matter when you're talking about Haiti? Consider the case of gold mining. The government of Haiti had not granted a gold mining concession in 50 years. They decided to do so during the reconstruction of their country, which was being overseen by Bill and Hillary Clinton. What company did they select to get this gold mining permit? A company called VCS Mining. VCS Mining had very little experience in gold mining, but what did they have? They had connections. Shortly after they got that concession, someone joined their board of directors. It just happened to be Tony Rodham, brother of Hillary Rodham Clinton.
The full comments can be heard on our website. Let's go to the talkback segment of our program. Let's say hello to Josh from Long Island. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Gary.
Josh, your turn.
Oh, good. Hello. I just wanted to see if you had any knowledge or any thoughts on the idea of during Occupy Wall Street, what if a foreign nation offered small arms support to those people protesting our government, the way, you know, kind of a mirror image of what we do in other nations? Is there any similarity there? Or
no, you've made a good point, Josh. Let's explore that for a moment. If you actually speak with people who've gone to Syria before and during the crisis, as well as in Libya, what you find is that you have one of the most open, progressive societies in the Middle East in Syria. And since 2000, when Assad took power, he has opened up more universities, more hospitals, more clinics, given more young people apartments, over 300,000, and had more freedom. You had the Alawites, which is a minority that he belongs to, the Christians, the Sunnis, the Shia, all living. It's a sectarian society. But we wanted Syria. We wanted it because Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait wanted to put gas lines through the country. And Assad didn't want that. So we then brought in provocateurs. There's now evidence that the provocateurs and the agents that we brought in, once we brought them in, then we were able to control the media coming back so that it was the peaceful demonstration turned into a bloody massacre because of Assad. That's not the way it happened. And so we refuse to take responsibility. The media refused to do what it's supposed to do. Don't accept a press release from the Pentagon or State Department. Send someone out there. You have the resources and do your homework. The same was true in Libya. Oh, he's going to bomb his own people. Or he's killing his own people. That wasn't true. In fact, there were no terrorists in Libya. In fact, Libya was the most prosperous country there. In fact, contrary to what a lot of people might want to believe, now you can like or dislike Gaddafi, that's your business. But simply compare Libya to the United States. They had more people represented in local decisions than the United States. You didn't have a group of wealthy people elected who then were controlled by lobbyists. That didn't happen. As a result, they frequently overrode Gaddafi. They had thousands and thousands of these small congresses of people. They would vote on everything in their communities. The oil revenue was then put into general funds, and every person got some of that. If you were married, you got a stipend. If you wanted a home, you got one for free. If you wanted to live on a farm, you were given a farm, tractor, seeds, anything you wanted. If you wanted an education, go to Harvard, they paid for it. If you were a woman, it was against the law to abuse a woman verbally or physically. Women had more rights in Libya, and more women were represented in professions and college graduation in their government than any other country in the Middle East or Africa, including the United States. And yet it was called the Paris of there, and they had the largest private-made water project to help irrigate the areas of Africa. Why do we never hear about this? We never hear the truth of why we invaded Libya. It's because he wanted to shift everything over to the gold denier and all the financial transactions in oil. That would have destabilized the dollar as U.S. reserve currency. And so that's how he had to go. Do we ever hear anyone even pretending to know the truth, wanting the truth, from the New York Times, from CNN? No. you will never get the truth from these organizations. They're just too co-opted. So yeah, if we had any foreign government arming, infiltrating, and provocateurs in the United States, as we have done all over the world, then the New York Times would rail against it, and we would know about it, and we would do everything possible to stop it. But as long as we are the hegemonic monster, we don't pay attention. That's part of what I was talking about our exceptionalism. I thank you, Josh, for bringing that to our attention. It's a valid comment. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. And Saturday, we're going to have only two more meetings of our health support group, and people are doing phenomenal. See you Saturday, 3 to 6 p.m., those who are in the group, and as we only have two meetings left. See everyone else back here tomorrow. Have a nice day.